Good afternoon, everybody. It's a delight to be able to make a little journey together over the next hour or so. And the focus of this workshop is on the critical issue of self-awareness and even awareness in general for leadership, and in this context for pastoral leadership and ministry leadership. And I think that all of us have had experiences where we have really seen leaders who were not aware, not highly self-aware, constantly find themselves in deep relational water just because of what happens when you function in that role without a strong sense of who you are and what you do best and what you don't do so well and how to partner effectively with other leaders in order to ensure that you have healthy leadership influences at work within the organization or the church community as a whole. So that's why when they asked me to do a workshop up here at PALCON, I mentioned this idea of the edge that this creates for leaders when they have a high degree of self-awareness. Yet all of the research shows that most people are rather self-unaware, and they tend to be cueing off of things that have been said to them over the history of their life by influential people, parents, teachers, pastors, coaches, whatever, that somewhat has kind of shaped the way they think about what their capacities are, their abilities are, etc. I'm going to give you a handout we can pass around that is my attempt to help you kind of get a sense of where I'm coming from on the whole topic of leadership from a Christian Jesus approach. I was actually driving from San Diego out to Palm Desert and stopped in a small town called Hemet to get some coffee at a Starbucks. And I had been writing a training curriculum for the Nazarene Strengths Institute on the seven demands of leadership. So all of this was in my brain there, trying to coalesce into a framework of a theological narrative of leadership. And so I stopped in at this Starbucks. All of a sudden, my ideation began to fire off, and I began to see an actual model of this, and I wanted to capture this really spectacular moment of insight. And I had a pen, but I didn't have any paper. But thankfully, the muffin came in a brown sack. And so I wrote out on this brown sack this kind of a way of seeing or thinking about Christian leadership. And it really begins right here at the center with this word relationship for me. I have taught and advocated, and I believe it more today than at any other time in my life, that ultimately the effectiveness of our ministry and what we do rests and depends on the quality of our relationships. And it's hard for me to divorce effectiveness from quality relationships. And certainly the lack of awareness on the part of a leader really does affect and get in the way of healthy, quality relationships. And this makes sense to me theologically, because even the scriptures going back to the Shema, and certainly when the wise man attorney came to Jesus and said, you know, you seem to know what you're talking about, and if you had to boil all this down to the essence, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus said what? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second is like unto it. Love your neighbor as yourself. So we get these two dimensions, really, of relationship that are very essential to our understanding theologically of love for God and love for others. But this makes sense even from a Trinitarian standpoint. And that's why I put this delta in the middle, because within the very nature of God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, there is community and there is love, and it exists right within the dynamic of that relationship. And then that love, by the nature of love, created others to love, and therefore I think it all kind of ties together for me in an understanding of Trinitarian theology and what the two great commandments are related to loving God and loving our neighbor. So that for me is kind of a dynamic core center out of which these now four components of leadership flow. The first is the character of a leader. And secondly, then, is the culture that that leader fosters and nurtures, which ultimately defines and shapes a community of people. And that community can function in a destructive way or in a fruitful, constructive way, and therefore make a contribution, a kingdom contribution, to their context, the neighborhood that they're in and where they're located, so that functionally the community is a benefit in kingdom terms to a parish. So out of this dynamic center core of relationship, and by that I mean the defining word is, of course, love in the way it's defined by Jesus, both in his teaching and by example. But also, when I'm talking about a quality relationship, there are some key words here. And the first one here is values. When we talk about character, I want to say growing out of a loving core of self-giving, we have to think in terms of the values that are then embodied, enfleshed, incarnated in the leadership. Now, my word here is behavior, because it's behavior that ultimately, I think, shapes the culture and, to a large extent, the behavior of a leader. Like I say, Robin, stick out your hand right here. I'm going to go around to everybody here, but I think you probably all do pretty much the same thing. Notice that I just said to Robin, stick out your hand. But as I began to apply pressure, what did he do? He did the same thing. Because I was giving him instructions by behavior, not in language. And so I was telling Robin kind of what to do through the pattern or the model, if you please, or the behavior of my life. And I think this is like leadership 101, but I just think of how often even world-class leaders violate this very principle. You know, it's the old, they don't walk their talk. And yet it's the walk or the behavior that is so powerful in ultimately shaping the nature of a culture. Not the language that's always used or what's advocated or preached in a sense, but that's kind of what is preached in the behavior, right? And then my other word here is this kind of self-giving love fosters engagement within a community, an engaged community. Some of you may know that research that has been done by Gallup on church members in the United States reveals that 29% of church members in the United States are engaged in their church. In that sense, they have their heart wrapped around the mission. 54% are not engaged. They attend, they participate, but their heart, they would never say, "Oh, I just love this church. I just love doing my ministry." They're really there, they attend, they participate, they like their church, but it's a different kind of a level of covenantal commitment that they're operating in. 29%. 29% are engaged, 54% are not engaged, and 17% are actively disengaged. They may be the complainers, the negative, be the occasional attenders, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if we could just take a percentage of that not engaged group that are actually the closest to being engaged and move them over, it would make a huge difference in the culture of a church. So I'm just arguing that a key word here is one of people being deeply engaged in this community. And then finally, the growth that comes out of this dynamic in the contribution that they make, because these people are growing. And as a result of that, the fruit that they bear increases. Now, connecting some of this are some linking, bridging dynamics. I think a key word, at least between character and culture, and the reason why behavior is so shaping, is the integrity and the consistency of character lived out in terms of the culture that shapes the community. And this is, I think, where accountability comes in. Leaders that are willing to be accountable for what they say and do, and are willing to be held accountable for what they say and do, is a part of that integrity piece. Okay, and then here I think of trust. Big word. I'm just telling you, in a church community, they thrive when there's trust between the leadership and that community. Agreed? And when there's mistrust and suspicion, everything becomes much more difficult and challenging. And yet you think of how many world-class leaders break trust and don't keep faith. And you would think this would be leadership 101 stuff. But we don't often really understand how important trust is within the body. And when Gallup asked 10,000 followers, "Give me a word that describes the leader you respect and are most likely to follow," and the word that was mentioned more often by far than any other word was the word trust. I have to be able to trust this person. It isn't a big surprise, but in another way, it validates how important integrity is and trust within the dynamics of leadership. And then it is fruit that comes out of this community that is the contribution that they bear in their place and time within the parish where God has called them to engage. And then finally, this is my word. It could be result. You might like that better. It could be outcome. What's the outcome of this? It is the fruit and the contribution that becomes the reward of leadership, or the outcome, the result of that leadership, which just feeds again into reaffirming the character of the leader, integrity, the sense of healthy, whole, loving, self-giving relationships. Okay, so this is the big picture. I wanted to just sort of get this maybe before you, before we dig down a little deeper in it, so you'd kind of know where I'm coming from here. But believe me, there have been hundreds of studies to determine the profile of the ideal pastor. I mean, for years, people have tried to research this profile. And what has happened as a result of this research is we are very convinced that there is none. There really is no generic universal cluster of skills or talent for effectiveness as a leader or as a pastor. However, we have found that people can be effective with a whole diverse set of these strengths and talents. And the one thing, though, that the research is showing is that there's one quality that is essential for effectiveness. And it's not a specific profile. It is this self-awareness. What the research today is showing is that for effectiveness in leadership, there must be a high degree of self-awareness. And it's pretty clear, it's really coming out in all of the leadership literature, that the best thing leaders can do to improve their effectiveness is to become more self-aware. And yet, many people don't really know how unique they are, and how uniquely they have been gifted to be effective. In fact, everything that I know about this subject area convinces me that each of you right now can do something better than anybody else in this room. In fact, I go so far to say that if there were 10,000 people in this room, I mean, it would not only be crowded, but you could do something better than 9,999 people in the room. Of course, the follow-up question is, do you know what that is? Have you come to that place of awareness that you can say, this is what I do best? And when I walk in the door, when I'm seated at the table, this is what comes with me. This is what I bring in the way of unique capacity to help us be effective in ministry and mission. How would you answer that question? You know, what is it that you do best? I mean, and that's a deeper question than just what are your strengths or what do you think are some of your natural areas of talent and ability, even though God-given. It's kind of how do those cluster and kind of dynamically link with each other in order to give you some kind of unique capacity that pretty much can only be done as At a level of effectiveness that's your level of effectiveness. When we talk about awareness, I think I want to broaden this a little bit beyond just self-awareness. Certainly that's the first starting point, huge piece, but there's also team awareness. I think you can see already how helpful it would be for you to know for sure, accurately, what you do best. But wouldn't it help you to know that about each person that you team with and what they do best, what their capacities are, so that you can effect deep complementary partnerships with people to enhance the leadership effectiveness within your community? And then finally, it's context and awareness of the context in which I'm serving, leading, pastoring. Okay, so if you begin with the importance of knowing yourself, I'd like you to read this definition with me. I hear. Let's read it out loud together. Leaders gain respect, support, and personal fulfillment by understanding themselves and staying true to their values. Through conscious introspection and reflection, they prepare to properly respond to any given situation. By knowing self, maintain and display congruency in their lives while facing the constant challenges of decision and change. So, Cornell University did this research project, and this is one of their findings. Notice that they finally bottomed out and said leadership searches give short shrift to self-awareness, which should actually be a top criterion. Interestingly, a high self-awareness score was the strongest predictor of overall success. So when they tried to kind of dig down to some of the key core dynamics of effectiveness and success in leadership, what they began to discover was they always ended up with high degree of self-awareness. In Gallup's research project, which involved 20,000 world-class senior leaders, studies of 1 million work teams, 50 years of polling on leadership, and like I said, interviewing 10,000 followers and the qualities of a leader that they respect and admire. And out of this, they had three key findings. And the first finding was that the most effective leaders are always investing in strengths, in capacity, in those natural abilities that are God-given to us. So much so that they found that when leaders fail to focus on individual talent and strength with the people they work with, the chances of an individual being engaged is only 1 out of 11, which is just 9%. Now, this makes some sense with what Gallup found out about the church. Remember, I said only 29% of members are engaged in their church. But when you ask the average church member this question, in your church, do you regularly have the opportunity to do what you do best? Less than a third say yes. Which means two-thirds of the respondents are saying, no, really, at my church, I don't regularly have the opportunity to do what I do best. So, sadly, an awful lot of capacity is being shelved, inaccessible, not contributing, just because people have the opportunity to participate and serve, but seldom in the area of their capacity. In other words, getting to do what they love to do. Can't you see how that would affect engagement level of engagement. If I get to do what I love to do with you in this community, that's going to ramp up my sense of engagement, having my heart into this. And when leadership focuses on these strengths and appreciates the unique contribution that people can make, the odds soar to 3 out of 4, which is 73%, which is an 8-fold increase in engagement. The second finding was that most effective leaders surround themselves with the right people and then maximize their team. And by right people, it means people who can complement for my capacities and help us to be full and complete. And then finally, the most effective leaders understand their team's needs, because if you know a person's unique capacities, what they do best, what they love to do, you also know what they need in a ministry service assignment. And you know what they don't need. You know what drains them, and you know what energizes them. So let's read this out loud together. A leader needs to know his or her strengths as a carpenter knows his tools or a physician knows the instruments at her disposal. What greater leaders have in common is that each truly knows his or her strengths and can call on the right strength at the right time. This explains why there is no definitive list of characteristics that describes all leader, because it's so dynamic here. People calling on the right tool, the right strength at the right time. So context, timing, appropriateness. But all of those are words that begin to fill in the definition of this word awareness. Now, I think even here now, we can learn a lot about awareness from Jesus. It's not unique for us as followers of Jesus to have him show us the way. Agreed? Now, I think all of us understand that the baby Jesus did not look up into his mother Mary's face and smile and say, "Hi, I'm the Son of God." That for Jesus, like for you and for me, there was a process of growth and development that occurred in this life over a 30-year period of time or more. So we do have these little brief snapshots in the Gospel of Luke that give us, though, reason to believe that there was normal human development going on in this young life. And the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom. Grace of God was on him. Or Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and favor of God. Just a little snapshot, but to me it's validating this idea of development of awareness that in a sense culminated in a very profound way that's recorded in all three synoptic gospels. I'm referring to a moment in history, a moment in Jesus' life and development. You could give it a date. We don't know the date, but you could give it one, because there was a specific day when Jesus awakened. He groomed himself, washed his face, dressed, maybe had a little breakfast, and he kissed his mother Mary goodbye. And because of some unique stirring, calling, inner voice, he knew it was time to begin what is often referred to as his earthly ministry. Now, conventional wisdom would say he ought to go down to Jerusalem if you're going to start a movement as a leader of influence, because that's the economic center, the political center, the religious center, that's where the great libraries, the scribes, the teachers, they're all there. Wouldn't you go there? But instead, following the Spirit, he goes out to the lonely wilderness where this guy John is baptizing, calling people to repentance, announcing and proclaiming the coming of the kingdom of God. And Jesus joins the human lineup, looking in the back of somebody's head, which is about as humiliating as you can get, and waited his turn to enter into the Jordan River to be baptized. And it's Luke uniquely says it was while Jesus was praying that three things happened. You recall one of those three things. Anybody here, talk to me. What happened there in that moment?
The voice of heaven said, "This is my beloved son."
Yeah. So the voice of the Father was heard. Somebody else. What else happened? Three things happened.
I'm thinking it sounded rushing wind, but I don't know.
Well, the Spirit
descended like a dove.
In bodily form. Spirit descended in bodily form like a dove. And one more. The texts all agree the heavens were open. So these three things happened kind of in this sequence. First, the heavens are opened, which is a direct answer to the ancient cry of the prophet, "God, when are you going to rend the heavens, tear the heavens, and come down to help us and save us?" And I think the implication is of the narrative right now, today, is happening. And then secondly, the Spirit descends like a dove, certainly saying this is a defining moment between heaven and earth in the cosmos. And then finally, the voice of the Father is heard. And we can read this for ourselves, and let's read it out loud. When all the people were being baptized, Jesus was baptized too. And as he was praying, heaven was opened, and the Holy Spirit descended on him in bodily form like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." Now, I think you would agree that these words are life-giving. "You're my son," or "You're my daughter, you belong to me, and I love you." Any parent that would say that to a child, these are formative, life-giving, shaping words, right? But there's more going on here in the biblical narrative. I think there probably are at least two really big, huge questions that every human being wrestles with. And the first is, who am I, really? And the second one is, why am I here? Now, they strike deeply at these two really fundamental life issues of identity and mission. I don't think these are just adolescent questions. These are not just university student questions. These are questions we ask all of our life. At least it's my experience. Believe it or not, I'm 76 years of age, and I'm still, you know, you'd think by now I'd have this all figured out, but the new season of my life where I am, I'm asking these questions. You know, now who am I? I don't really have an office. I don't have an administrative assistant. I mean, when I had to come beg somebody to make some handouts for me in a copy machine, I mean, you used to have a whole team. I mean, I just say, "Hey, make this for me," and now I got to go down to, my administrative assistant is the UPS store, but they want 25 cents a copy for colored stuff, and I'm going, "I'm not paying that." So anyway, I'm just saying, who am I now? But also, why am I still here? Because a lot of my friends are not here, but I am. So what do I do with that? And I think those are formative questions. I think those are huge life questions. And if we want to talk about self-awareness and a defining moment for Jesus, it has to be in this moment when he hears the word of the Father saying, "You're my son, whom I love." Those are identity words. But how deep this goes is quite amazing in the fact that they are a direct quote from Psalm 2, verse 7. Now, that means, and we go back to Psalm 2, 7 and see what's going on there. Jesus knew the scriptures, knew the tradition, and Old Testament scholars tell us that Psalm 2 is the psalm that was played and sung at the coronation of every king in Israel. And the voice of the Father is quoting that psalm. Now, you want to talk about messianic tradition, kingship, identity, who am I? The Father says, "You're my son, whom I love," and all that rich tradition. But also, this phrase, "in whom I'm well pleased," is a direct quote from Isaiah 42, verse 1, where we begin the whole suffering servant passages, and the one who would come to lay down his life, walk the road of self-giving, sacrificial love. And so it seems to me this is now the character of the mission. This is what I'm calling you to do, is to walk this road of self-giving love. And you all know that's quite a tension, because messianic expectations and kingship don't go along with self-giving, serving love. But the Father said, "No, this is who you are and who I'm calling you to be and what I'm calling you to do." Shouldn't surprise us then that we turn the page and we find Jesus living this out. Living out of the love of his Father and living that love out in all of the relationships of his life. So, next paragraph in Luke, we're in the synagogue. And it's Jesus' turn to read the scriptures. And he picks up, big surprise, the scroll of Isaiah. Turns to chapter 42. And he reads this. And then he turns and looks folks like you and I in the eye and says, "Today, this is fulfilled in your very hearing." You see, these are no longer old words, ancient words on a dusty old scroll. These words now are embodied in my life. This is who I am and what I'm called to do. This is my mission and my identity right here. And this is what I'm going to be about. Turn the page. Next paragraph in Luke, and look what's going on. At sunset, already, he's healing, laying hands on the sick, living out the mission in the marketplace is being realized. And even the text says the demons get it. They're saying, "Wow, you really are the Son of God." In fact, you can't understand the temptation episodes without having this background of identity and mission. Because Satan does everything he can to derail the mission and say, "You don't have to walk this suffering love stuff to be a king. If you want to be a king, Jesus, just pick up rocks and drop bread and people will follow you." Because we know that whoever feeds the world, what? Rules the world. And then we have this concluding paragraph in Luke, and it just again is affirming this calling and this mission, and even people are trying to keep him from leaving, and he says, no, I have to go, because that's why I was sent. Read this through the words of Alan Hirsch, talking about we are sent people. And so if Jesus was not called to stay, neither are we, if we're going to follow him. We're going to have to run to catch up, because he's going to go. And I think his calling is our calling. And we have examples of that even throughout the scriptures of Moses' calling, his equivocation. I'm not the guy. You need to have Aaron, because I don't have communication in my talent set. I don't need that. I need you. David, he's going to go out and fight Goliath, and Saul says, you better put on my armor, and he tries it on, says, this doesn't fit. You know, I got to fight with my stuff and my strengths, five smooth stones. And then even Paul, you know, he was a talented, gifted person before the Damascus Road encounter. Afterwards, he didn't get a whole new personality set of talents and skills. It's just who's going to benefit from the investment of who Paul is. So I think God calls each one of us to go into the world being the person that he has uniquely created us to be. He's not, you know, that old, it was really a rabbi, but I translated it and say, God isn't going to ask me, why weren't you more like Rick Warren or Bill Hybels or something? He's going to say, why weren't you more like the Norm Shoemaker that I created you to be? So read this out loud. I really think this is a tremendous quote. Let's read it. Vocation does not mean a goal that I pursue. It means a calling that I hear. And before I can tell my life what I intend to do with it, I must listen for what it intends to do with me. And then this. Vocation does not come from a voice out there calling me to become something I am not. It comes from a voice in here calling me to be the person I was born to be, the original selfhood given to me at birth by God. Wow. So, again, I'd ask, do you know your vocation and what you do best? Stand up if you almost always talk to people on elevators. You can raise your hand. If you always talk to people on elevators, airplanes, checkout lines, raise your hand. Is that you? Okay, we've got a couple. What about clean the house apartment before you can relax? Nobody. No clean, neat freaks here. Hang the shirts in your closet according to color or your blouses. Anybody organize their closets like that? Okay, make a list of things to do. Have my things to do list. And do you make a list on your day off? How many? Yeah. How about on your vacation? Anybody here make a list? Yeah. What if you do something that's on your list? What do? Cross it off. Because it feels so good, right? You just love crossing those puppies off there. And what if you do something and it's not on your list? Add it to the list and then cross it off because it feels good. And what if you have 15 things in your list, but you only got 14 of them done and checked off? It's like, and what do you do with that 15th item that didn't get, it gets put on the top of the list for the next day so that then maybe you can cross it off, feel good, yeah. How about those of you that are always planning the next get-together and you just like organizing parties and social events? Let's go to the mall. Let's go to dinner. Yeah, I think that probably is true. And you're accused of being too nice. You know, your problem is you're just too nice. How many would say that's me? Okay. Well, and how many would say I'm accused of being not too nice? How many are always kind of asking a lot of questions? And people say, how come you have to ask so many questions? And you're sitting there, how many questions would be too many questions? How many of you are always doing, doing, doing? You just have to be doing something, you know. And how many of you push the elevator button again and again just to keep reminding the elevator, I'm down here and I'm waiting on you? Anybody here? That's me. Well, this demonstrates not only diversity, because you raised your hand sometimes, other times you didn't, others did. What's the difference here? I can tell you that all of these fundamentally go back to a narrative of strengths and talents, and you raised your hand because of how you've been shaped and what your talent themes are. And Ephesians 2:10 says we are God's workmanship. We're actually created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared for us in advance to do through His Spirit. So I have found over the years as a pastor that most people really get into this question. What am I to do? I think I need to help. But I don't know what to do. Students say to me, Norm, if God would tell me what to do, I'd do it. And I know they would. But I think there's a prior question here, and an awareness, and that is, how have you been shaped? I mean, what do you do well, and what do you do best, and what do you not do so well? And that's a pretty strong clue, I would think, to what we're supposed to do with our life. And Galatians 6, 4-5 says it like this in the Message. Let's read it out loud. Make a careful exploration of who you are and the work you have been given, and then sink yourself into that. Don't be impressed with yourself. Don't compare yourself with others. Each of you must take responsibility for doing the creative best you can with your own life. Yeah. But the problem is there are a lot of people who are very self-unaware. They don't see themselves as gifted or talented because we've tended to popularize and stereotype talent around things like athleticism, music, singing, dancing, acting, and we say, now there's talent. In fact, I would argue that the way most of us define talent is if we see somebody doing something impressive that we know we cannot do, we would say there's talent, which makes me a zero. Failing to appreciate that I have some talent like that that other people are looking at and saying, boy, I could never do that. Most people really don't appreciate the fact that they really have been equipped to make a kingdom contribution, and largely because we have all been raised in a weakness-fixing world. More people of influence have tried to catch us doing something not so well and improve us. You brought a report card home. It had 2 A's, 2 B's, and a D. Where did the attention go? We all know. A D. We got to fix that. Nobody said, wow, 2 A's, 2 B's, cool. No, it was always a D. That's below the line. See, our thinking is that we know what average is, and we want everybody at least to get up to average. Andy, we noticed, and we've been watching you here at the school, and we can see readily that you're a really good reader, and you're way above average, but also we've noticed that you're not so great with math, and you're sort of below the line there. And so what we're going to do for you, Andy, is improve you. And so you don't need to read anymore. So we're going to take all of your books away And we're going to give you two periods of math.
I don't like that.
Yeah. You don't like it. And at about grade 9 or 10, you're wanting out of this system.
Yeah.
Because what we're doing is taking away things that energize you, put wind in your sails to give you a double dose of what de-energizes you, right? And it's all about helping people be average. Do you see how this is a perfect recipe for mediocrity? Telling everybody, spend all your energy, all your money, all your time on some incremental improvement. When all the research shows that if you put that same amount of time around a talent area, you'd soar. You wouldn't just get a blip on the screen. You would just have a quantum leap in terms of capacity. So the truth is, you're at your best when you do what you naturally do best. I mean, this is just a no-brainer. And yet we say things like, honey, you can be anything you want to be. Not true. You can be anything you want to be if the talent is there for you. But don't tell people that it can just be anything they want to be. Or you can learn anything if you just try hard enough. Now, if you take the logic of that and people aren't learning it and they're not getting it, what's the conclusion? They're not trying, which now is an indictment on them as a person. Or the best do things the same way. You know, we know leaders all have a common profile. Now, there's lots of ways to be effective. None of this is helpful. In fact, you have to kind of defy this conventional wisdom in order to really understand awareness. And I think there's some tragedy in this. We don't know who we are, true self created by God. Most people spend their lives trying to live up to expectations that have nothing to do with their unique creation. And also they go to their graves, never knowing who God has really called them to be. And I'd love to take time just to meet each one of you and talk about what you do best. And one of the questions that's fun to think about is, what energizes you? I mean, just by your own experience. When you get to do this, you just love doing it. They wouldn't have to pay you to. I mean, you just love doing this. Or what really drains you? And you just have to say, boy, it just takes the wind out of myself. I procrastinate. I never get around to it. I drag my feet. It's just unpleasant. And we all have those kind of things. But the great discovery of my life in all of this awareness one time was that there are people who love to do what drains me. Truly. And I spent years trying to protect people that work for me and with me from the things that drain me, because I thought, what kind of a friend am I if I dump all that junk on them? They said, I know what Norm is doing. He didn't want to do that. Why does he think I want to do that? But then I discovered that the things that drain me and take the life out of me, there are people who can't wait to get up in the morning to do them. And that made a big difference for me, even in who I hired to work with. Another myth is you've the greatest room for growth and your areas of greatest weakness. This gets back to this kind of weakness fixing thing that says, hey, Andy, you're up here in reading. If you're down here in math, where do you have room to grow? You can go all, I mean, you've capped out on this, so look how much room you have to grow here. And what we get is a research project in Nebraska at Lincoln, the city of Lincoln, and they took all of their young people through a reading test to see how fast they read and the level of comprehension. And then they all went through a speed reading course to improve reading, and then at the end they retested them to see if there was improvement. Here's the result. Average readers before the skill building seminar, they were reading 90 words a minute. And at the end of the skill training, they were reading 150 words a minute. Is that an improvement? Yeah. Is that good? Yeah, it's great. If you're reading 90 and now you're reading 100, that's good. But look at this. The talented readers were reading 350 words a minute. And then they went through the same course. Anyone want to venture a guess? The speed they're reading. What do you think? 2,900 words a minute. And they're going, wow, just that's what all the researchers said. We just discovered something here. Where do you think you have room for growth? Around these kind of talent theme areas. So, it's time for us to go. And I'm just going to stop. I have two more things, but I'm going to let you go because in keeping faith with the 1 hour that I have to do this workshop, unlike some other speakers here, I'm going to quit. Yeah, that's right. So I'm just saying, if you want to hear those two things, if you need to leave and go, hey, it's great to see you. Thank you so much. This is maybe my example of how awareness affects relationship. Remember I said I've just seen people muck up relationships by lack of awareness. Here's the way this works. I assume that I'm an average person. I think most of you assume you're kind of an average human being. You don't think of yourself as a superstar talent. And so, the next assumption is, as an average human being, if I can do this, so can you. You see that? I'm an average guy. And if I can do this, so can you. Which is a false assumption. Because there are some things that are not average in me because of talent. And I get there quicker than some others. And I can't say, if I can do this as quickly, so can you. This happens with our children. It happens between spouses. And what is going on is because I devalue my talent, not realizing how strong it can be in certain areas, I make this assumption that if I'm capable of doing this, so can you. If I can be on time, you can be on time. And therefore, if you're not, you don't care, it doesn't matter, you're not trying, these kind of judgments. So this devaluing of my talent causes me to be judgmental of other people, of my children, of my spouse, the people in my church. They're not very committed. If I can do this, so can you. But that's just not a true, accurate assumption. And then it's easy for us to devalue talent that we see in other people because it can be irritating to us because we don't understand it. And so my brother Craig may have command as a talent, but I would say, he's nothing but bossy. What did I just do? I devalued that talent in him. Got Andy here. He has giftedness for harmony and relationships, and he's a guy that's always working for middle ground consensus. But I say, you know, why are you such a wimp? Why don't you take a stand? Or you hear words like nerd, egghead, people that kind of probably are intellection kind of folks. People with high discipline are really irritate some people. It's kind of like, you know, why do we, you know, you're so rigid and legalistic about this stuff. Why does it have to be done on time? Just because you're a little deal? See, these are the things that we live with in relationships. But a lot of it goes back to just our ignorance, lack of awareness of our own talent and the talent of other people. Okay? I have a handout that I'll close with just so you can take it with you, because it gets us beyond ourselves to other people around us. And for what it's worth, those of you that are leaders in churches, take a look at some research that was done by Gallup on four functions of leadership that are essential for health in any organization. And what they found was that there have to be executors, influencers, relationship builders, and strategic thinkers. At a pretty strong level for any organization to be healthy. You have to have these functions at a high level. But one of the things they discovered, my friends, is of the 20,000 people they interviewed and studied, they couldn't find one who was great at all four. And so the point here is, you're not going to be great at all four. I know I'm not great at all four. So if I'm not great at all four of these, and yet they're essential for health in my church, then I've got to locate the people who fill in the pieces there and team with them and get them connected deeply with this vision and mission, because we have to have all four of these things functioning here. It's like a four-cylinder engine. You can't cock out two of those cylinders and run the thing, you know? So you got to have all four cylinders working at a high level of efficiency. And I'm not going to be great at all four of those things. And part of it is being aware of your team and people around you and saying, if I'm high as an executor and maybe relationship builder, I've got to find those strategic people and always invite them to be at the table, especially if we're doing a plan, because I'm not going to be so great at coming up with a plan. Give me the plan and I will do that thing. I'm an executor, but don't ask me to think it all up. So that's the idea of team awareness as well as self-awareness. It's got to go both ways. They need to know who you are, what you do best, what you don't do so well, and vice versa.